Because we step more carefully, we're less likely to fall through cognitive trapdoors like confirmation bias. One study of CEOs found that encouraging business leaders to reflect on their regrets exerted a positive influence on their future decisions. Barry Schwartz, one of the first social psychologists to take regret seriously, explains that this unpleasant feeling serves several important functions. Regret can emphasize the mistakes we made in arriving at a decision so that should a similar situation arise in the future, we won't make the same mistakes. This theme ran through many of the entries in the World Regret Survey, including this one from a parent with a long memory.
I yelled at my daughter when she was 5, on the way to school, when she spilled some yogurt on her uniform. I really laid into her, and I have regretted it ever since. She didn't deserve that. I upset her so much, and for what? A bit of a stain on her uniform? I will never stop regretting that moment. I have never yelled at her in that way again, so I learned from that mistake, but I wish I could take that moment back.
This parent still feels bad about past behavior, but has used that feeling to make different decisions going forward and never scream at the child that way again. While some of us parents are still trying to improve our decision-making, the capacity for regret might be a fundamental part of how our sons and daughters learn to reason and make decisions themselves. Irish researchers, across several experiments, have shown that children's decision-making capabilities improve tremendously once they cross the developmental threshold, around age 7, that allows them to experience regret. The development of regret allows children to learn from previous decisions in order to adaptively switch their choices, write Emer O'Connor, Teresa McCormick, and Aidan Feeney. Our cognitive apparatus is designed, at least in part, to sustain us in the long term rather than bomb us in the near term. We need the ability to regret our poor decisions, to feel bad about them, precisely so we can improve those decisions in the future. 2. Regret can boost performance. Clairvoyance smash egg pools. That's an anagram for psychologists love anagrams. And it's true. Anagrams are a staple of psychological research. Usher participants into a room, give them some words or phrases to rearrange into other words or phrases, then manipulate their mood, their mindset, their environment, or any other variable to see how it affects their performance. For example, in one experiment, Keith Markman from one of the negotiation studies and 2 colleagues gave participants 10 anagrams to solve. After supposedly grading the results, they told participants they'd found only half of the available words. Then they poked people with a little regret. Close your eyes and think about your actual performance on the anagrams compared to how you might have performed better, they told the participants. Take a minute and vividly evaluate your performance in comparison to how you might have performed better. Their heads now swimming with if-onlys, these puzzle solvers felt worse, especially compared to another group that had been asked to make at least comparisons. But on the next round, the regretful group solved more puzzles and stuck with the task longer than anyone else in the experiment. This is one of the central findings on regret. It can deepen persistence, which almost always elevates performance. One of the pioneers in studying counterfactual thinking, Neil Rose, whose research appears throughout this audiobook, used anagrams in one of his earliest and most influential papers. He too found that inducing regret, poking participants with if-onlys, enabled people to solve more anagrams and to solve them faster. Or, leave the laboratory and enter the casino. One intriguing experiment, also led by Markman, asked people to play blackjack against a computer. The experimenters told half the participants that after the first round, they'd depart. They told the other half that after the first round, they'd play a few more hands. People who knew they'd be playing again generated many more if-onlys than people who were one and done. They were more likely to regret pursuing a flawed card-playing strategy or taking too much or too little risk. The first group, meanwhile, avoided negativity. They mostly generated at least I didn't lose all my money. But the card players in the second group willingly initiated the unpleasant process of experiencing regret because they needed preparative information to help them perform better, the researchers wrote. Participants who did not expect to play again needed no such information and instead wanted only to feel good about their current performance. Even thinking about other people's regrets may confer a performance boost. Several studies have introduced a character named Jane, who's attending a concert of her favorite rock band. Jane begins the concert in her ticketed seat, but then moves to another seat to be closer to the stage. A bit later, the band announces that promoters will soon randomly select a seat and give a free trip to Hawaii to whoever is sitting in it. Sometimes the participants in this experiment hear that the seat that Jane recently switched to is the one that wins the free trip. Rejoice! Other times, participants hear that the seat Jane left is the one that wins. Regret! People who heard Jane's if-only saga and then took a section of the law school admission test scored 10% higher than a control group. They also did a better job of solving complex puzzles like the Dunker candle problem, a famous experimental test of creative thinking. Getting people to think counterfactually, to experience even vicarious regret, seems to crack open the door to possibilities, Galinsky from the negotiation studies and Gordon Moskowitz explain. It infused people's subsequent deliberations with more strength, speed, and creativity. To be sure, regret doesn't always elevate performance. Lingering on a regret for too long or replaying the failure over and over in your head can have the opposite effect. Selecting the wrong target for your regret, say that you wore a red baseball cap at the blackjack table rather than that you took another card when you were holding a 10 and a king, offers no improvement. And sometimes the initial pain can momentarily throw us. But most times, reflecting even a bit on how we might benefit from a regret boosts our subsequent showing. Feelings of regret spurred by setbacks might even be good for your career. A 2019 study by the Kellogg School of Management's Yang Wang, Benjamin Jones, and Dashen Wang looked at a 15-year database of applications that junior scientists had submitted for a prestigious National Institutes of Health grant. The study authors selected more than 1,000 applications that hovered near the rating threshold necessary to win the grant. About half the applicants just cleared the threshold. They got the grant, eked out a narrow win, and eluded regret. The other half fell just short. These applicants missed the grant, endured a narrow miss, and suffered regret. Then the researchers examined what happened to these scientists' careers. People in the narrow miss, if only group, systematically outperformed those in the narrow win, at least group in the long run. These silver Emmas of science were subsequently cited much more often, and they were 21% more likely to produce a hit paper. The researchers concluded that it was the setback itself that supplied the fuel. The near miss likely prompted regret, which spurred reflection, which revised strategy, which improved performance. 3. Regret can deepen meaning. A few decades ago, I spent 4 years in Evanston, Illinois, where I earned an undergraduate degree from Northwestern University. I'm generally happy with my college experience. I learned a ton and made several lifelong friends. But I've occasionally wondered what my life would have been like had I not been able to go to college or if I'd attended another university. And for some strange reason, those musings always make me more, not less, satisfied with the experience, as if this small slice of time was somehow integral to the full story of my life. Turns out, I'm not that special. In 2010, a team of social scientists that included Cray, Galinsky, and Rose asked a collection of Northwestern undergraduates to reflect counterfactually about their choice of college and their choice of friends during college. When the students engage in this sort of thinking, imagining they'd attended a different university or fallen in with a different set of pals, their reaction was like mine. The choice somehow felt more significant. Counterfactual reflection endows both major life experiences and relationships with greater meaning, the Northwestern study concluded. And this effect isn't limited to periods when we're young and self-absorbed. In fact, other research has found that people who thought counterfactually about pivotal moments in their life experienced greater meaning than people who thought explicitly about the meaning of those events. The indirect path of if only and at least offered a faster route to meaning than the direct path of pondering meaning itself. Likewise, when people consider counterfactual alternatives to life events, they experience higher levels of religious feeling and a deeper sense of purpose than when they simply recount the facts of those events. This way of thinking can even increase feelings of patriotism and commitment to one's organization. While these studies examine the broader category of counterfactuals, regret in particular deepens our sense of meaning and steers our lives toward its pursuit. For instance, conducting a midlife review focused on regrets can prompt us to revise our life goals and aim to live life afresh. Or take Abby Henderson, a 29-year-old behavioral health researcher who contributed to the World Regret Survey.
I regret not taking advantage of spending time with my grandparents as a child. I resented their presence in my home and their desire to connect with me, and now I'd do anything to get that time back.
Henderson grew up the youngest of three siblings in a happy home in Phoenix, Arizona. Her paternal grandparents lived in the small town of Hartford City, Indiana. Just about every winter, to escape the Midwest cold, they'd visit for a month or two, usually staying at the Henderson house. Young Abby was not into it. She was a quiet kid whose parents both worked, so she relished the time after school when she could hang out at home by herself. Her grandparents disturbed that peace. Her grandmother, waiting for her when she returned from classes, always wanted to hear about her day. And Abby resisted the attempts at connection. Now she regrets it. "The biggest regret is that I didn't hear their stories," she told me in an interview. But that has altered her approach to her own parents. Sparked by this regret, she and her siblings bought their father, who's in his 70s, a subscription to Storyworth. Each week, the service sends an email that contains a single question. What was your mother like? What is your fondest childhood memory? And yes, what regrets do you have? The recipient responds with a story, and at the end of the year, those stories are compiled into a hardcover book. "Because of the poke of if only," she said, "I seek out more meaning. I seek out more connection. I don't want to feel the way when my parents die that I felt about my grandparents of, what did I miss?" Abby says this ache helped her see her own life as a puzzle with meaning as the centerpiece. "When people around me say no regrets, I push back and say, if you don't make mistakes, how are you going to learn and grow?" she told me. "I mean, who makes it through their 20s without regrets? The bad jobs I took, the bad dates I went on." But she eventually discovered that every time she had a regret, it was in part because I was trying to remove meaning from the equation. One of the traits Abby remembers about her grandmother was her otherworldly baking skills, especially the pie she regularly served for dessert. "If all you've ever had is flavorless pie, you're going to think pies are meh. But once you've had my grandmother's strawberry pie, there is no going back." For Abby, there's a metaphor lurking in that baking tin. "My life is more flavorful because of my regret," she told me. "I remember the bitterness of the taste of regret. So when something is sweet, good God, it's so much sweeter." She knows she'll never get the time back with her grandparents. "It's a flavor that will always be missing," she says. Collecting the stories of her father, which she wouldn't have done without the prod of if only, helps. "It's a beautiful substitute," she says. "But it isn't a replacement. Nothing will fill that flavor. I will spend the rest of my life with a little bit of a gap, but that's going to inform everything else that I do." When we handle it properly, regret can make us better. Understanding its effects hones our decisions, boosts our performance, and bestows a deeper sense of meaning. The problem, though, is that we often don't handle it properly. What are feelings for? At some point, nearly every popular audiobook about human behavior wheels out William James, the 19th century American polymath and Harvard professor who wrote the first psychology textbook, taught the first psychology course, and is widely considered to be the founding parent of the field. This audiobook will now honor that tradition. In chapter 22 of his 1890 masterwork, The Principles of Psychology, James contemplated the purpose of the human ability to think. He proposed that how we think, even what we think, depends on our situation. Now that I am writing, it is essential that I conceive my paper as a surface for inscription, he wrote. If I failed to do that, I should have to stop my work. But in other situations, suppose he needed to light a fire and nothing else was available, he'd think of the paper differently. The paper itself has infinite variations. A combustible, a writing surface, a thin thing, a hydrocarbonaceous thing, a thing 8 inches one way and 10 another, a thing just 1 furlong east of a certain stone in my neighbor's field, an American thing, etc., etc., ad infinitum. Then he dropped an intellectual grenade that reverberates still today. My thinking is first and last and always for the sake of my doing. Modern psychologists have affirmed James's observation while shaving off 10 words in the service of pith. Thinking is for doing. We act in order to survive. We think in order to act. But feelings are more complicated. What is the purpose of emotions, especially unpleasant emotions like regret? If thinking is for doing, what is feeling for? One view. Feeling is for ignoring. Emotions aren't significant, this perspective holds. They're mere annoyances, distractions from serious matters. Better to bat them away or cast them into oblivion. Focus on the hard-headed, eschew the soft-hearted, and you'll be fine. Alas, stashing negativity in your emotional basement merely delays the moment when you must open the door and face the mess you've stored inside. Blocked emotions, writes one therapist, can even lead to physical problems like heart disease, intestinal problems, headaches, insomnia, and autoimmune disorders. Burying negative emotions doesn't dissipate them. It intensifies them, and the contaminants leach into the ground soil of our lives. Consistently diminishing negative emotions isn't a sound strategy either. It risks turning you into Professor Pangloss from Candide, who, when dealt one catastrophe after another, simply declares, "All for the best in the best of all possible worlds." Minimizing techniques like at least counterfactuals do have their place, as I'll explain in Chapter 12. They can soothe us, and sometimes we need soothing. But they can also supply us with false comfort and strip us of the tools to address cold reality, becoming a downward-facing dogma that undermines decisions and blunts growth. Another view. Feeling is for feeling. According to this position, emotions are the essence of our being. Talk about them. Vent about them. Luxuriate in them. Always trust your feelings, this perspective says. They are to be honored, sat upon a throne and revered. Emotions are the one real truth. They are all there is. All the rest is commentary. For negative emotions, especially regret, this approach is even more perilous than the Panglossian strategy of delusion through illusion. Too much regret is dangerous, sometimes devastating. It can lead to rumination, which severely degrades well-being, and to the regurgitation of past mistakes, which can inhibit forward progress. Excessive regret is linked to an array of mental health problems, most prominently depression and anxiety, but also post-traumatic stress disorder. Individuals who ruminate on their regrets are more likely to report reduced life satisfaction and to experience difficulty coping with negative life events, concludes one paper. This is especially true when regrets become repetitive. Repetitive thought can worsen regret, and regret can exacerbate repetitive thought, creating a descending spiral of pain. Rumination doesn't clarify and instruct. It muddies and distracts. When feeling is only for feeling, we build a chamber from which it's difficult to escape. When it comes to regret, a third view is healthier. Feeling is for thinking. Don't dodge emotions. Don't wallow in them either. Confront them. Use them as a catalyst for future behavior. If thinking is for doing, feeling can help us think. This approach is akin to the modern science of stress. Stress! It sounds bad. But stress, we now know, is not a single unmalleable entity. Much of how it affects us, even what it fundamentally is, depends on our individual mindset. If we think of stress as permanent and debilitating, that tugs us in one direction. If we think of it as temporary and enhancing, that leads us in a different direction. Chronic, omnipresent stress is poisonous. But occasional acute stress is helpful, even essential. Regret can work in a similar way. For example, framing regret as a judgment of our underlying character, who we are, can be destructive. Framing it as an evaluation of a particular behavior in a particular situation, what we did, can be instructive. Suppose you forgot a loved one's birthday. A regret about being a clueless, uncaring person won't help. A regret about not keeping important dates in one's computer calendar or not regularly expressing gratitude to relatives is useful. Ample research shows that people who accept rather than judge their negative experiences end up faring better. Likewise, framing regret as an opportunity rather than a threat helps us transform it so that it operates as a sharp stick rather than a leaden blanket. Regrets that hurt deeply but dissolve quickly lead to more effective problem solving and sturdier emotional health. When regret smothers, it can weigh us down, but when it pokes, it can lift us up. The key is to use regret to catalyze a chain reaction. The heart signals the head initiates action. All regrets aggravate. Productive regrets aggravate, then activate. When you feel the spear of regret, you have three possible responses, and your response determines your result. You can conclude that feeling is for ignoring and bury or minimize it. That leads to delusion. You can conclude that feeling is for feeling and wallow in it. That leads to despair. Or you can conclude that feeling is for thinking and address it. What does this regret tell you? What instructions does it offer for making better decisions, for improving your performance, for deepening your sense of meaning? When feeling is for thinking and thinking is for doing, regret is for making us better. In the 15th century, or so the story goes, a Japanese shogun named Ashikaga Yoshimasa dropped a Chinese tea bowl, which broke into several pieces when it hit the floor. He sent the damaged bowl back to China to be repaired. But what he received in return months later was an ungainly mess of an object, the bowl's pieces held together by bulky metal staples. There's got to be a better way, he thought, and he asked local craftspeople to find it. They chose to repair the pottery by sanding down the edges of the broken pieces and gluing them back together using lacquer mixed with gold. The artisan's goal wasn't to faithfully reproduce the original work or even to conceal its newly acquired flaws. It was to transform the piece into something better. Their work established a new and now centuries-old art form called kintsugi. By the 17th century, according to one report, kintsugi was such a fashionable phenomenon that some people were known to smash their tea bowls on purpose in order to embed them with gold-veined repairs. Kintsugi, which translates to golden joinery, considers the breaks and the subsequent repairs part of the vessel's history, fundamental elements of its being. The bowls aren't beautiful despite their imperfections. They're beautiful because of the imperfections, the cracks, make them better. What's true for ceramics can also be true for people. Just ask Mara Abbott. If you can't quite place the name, I'll refresh your memory. In the 2016 Olympic road race I described in the previous chapter, she's the American rider who lost the lead in the final moments and finished in fourth place. The days that followed the race were some of the largest experience of heartbreak that I've ever felt, she told me via Zoom one February afternoon from Buffalo, Wyoming, where she now works as a newspaper reporter. The word she uses to capture the experience? Shattering. Yet, she reassembled the pieces and found new insights in the fissures. The Rio contest was the last race of a successful 10-year cycling career. The experience didn't improve her times or earn her another trophy, but it somehow gave me this touchstone and perspective that makes other decisions and value judgments easier for me, she said. Most of all, she yearns to recapture the experience of being as fully engaged and alive as she was on that August afternoon. The opportunity and feeling that I got out of that loss, and that fullness and that wholeness, is the greatest privilege I could have ever asked for. Because of the pain, she sees the rest of her life with greater urgency and purpose. If you have a broken heart, it means you have done something big enough and important enough and valuable enough to have broken your heart, she told me. As Mara Abbott suggests, the cracks are how the light gets in. And as we'll see in the next section, peering through those cracks offers a glimpse of the good life. Part 2. Regret Revealed.
Me arrepiento no haber cambiado mis hábitos alimenticios desde joven. Fumé y he consumido mucho alcohol. También consumía carne los tres tiempos de comida casi mi vida entera. Hace 6 meses, cambié a un estilo de vida vegano y me he sentido mejor que nunca antes en mi vida. Solo me pongo a pensar si hubiera hecho esto desde joven.
I regret that I didn't change my eating habits during my youth, and that I smoked and drank a lot of alcohol. I also ate meat 3 meals a day for most of my life. 6 months ago, I became a vegan, and I've never felt better in my life. I just wonder how things could have been if I'd done this when I was young. Male, 46, Honduras.
I spent too much time trying to meet others' idea of normal. Accept yourself. Love your neighbor, and make each day a special memory. Non-binary, 62, Utah.
My biggest regret is not using my time as a stay-at-home mom to really teach my children about their relationship with God and Jesus Christ. I could have used my time with them better, to help them develop and strengthen their faith, which in turn would have given them the best foundation to succeed in life. Female, 54, Minnesota.
5. Regret on the surface. My body is not a temple. It's a storage unit for my regrets. At Ellie Crimendahl, Twitter, 2020. What do people regret? That's a question that pollsters and professors have been asking since the middle of the 20th century. In 1949, for instance, George Gallup, founder of the American Institute of Public Opinion, surveyed U.S. citizens about what they considered to be the biggest mistake of their lives. Their number one answer was a resounding, "Don't know." 4 years later, Gallup returned with what is likely the first polling question directly about regret. Generally speaking, his team asked in 1953, if you could live your life over again, would you live it in much the same way as you have, or would you live it differently? A majority of Americans said they wouldn't change a thing. This discomfort with admitting and enumerating hardship makes sense. Think about life in 1953. World War II lingered in the public memory. The United Kingdom, with a newly crowned 27-year-old queen, was still rationing food. Japan and much of Europe were digging out of devastation. It was the year Joseph Stalin died, the Korean War ended, and the first polio vaccine was developed. With the exterior world so fraught, interior contemplation might have felt indulgent. Navel gazing was still a few years from becoming a national pastime. Yet, peeking through the unease was a theme that researchers would slowly come to endorse. In the 1949 poll, the runner-up to don't know for biggest mistake was didn't get enough education. In the 1953 poll, among those who had regrets, the top choice, selected by 15% of the sample, was get more education. That too makes sense. In 1953, just 6% of the U.S. population had attended 4 or more years of college. More than half of Americans had not completed high school. Brown versus Board of Education, the U.S. Supreme Court case that declared segregated public schools a violation of the Constitution, was still a year away. More Americans were beginning to imagine the possibilities of education in the future, which perhaps meant that more regretted not having or pursuing those possibilities in the past. By 1965, when Gallup conducted a poll for Look magazine about what Americans would do differently if they had a chance to relive their lives, 43% chose get more education, nearly three times what respondents said 8 years earlier. Over the ensuing decades, pollsters became less interested in regret, but academics assumed the mantle. In the 1980s, Janet Landman and Jean Manis of the University of Michigan examined the regrets of a collection of both female undergraduates and adult women who'd visited the university's career center. The top regrets of each group landed squarely in the realm of education. For the older women, if-only thoughts typically involved curtailing their studies too early. In 1989, Arlene Matha and Richard Kinnear of Arizona State University surveyed the major regrets of women in three age cohorts: those in their 20s, people between the ages of 35 and 55, and those 64 and older. Across all three groups, the top regret they chose was, I would have taken my education more seriously and worked harder on it. A different set of Arizona State researchers surveyed community college students a few years later and found similar results. Educational academic regrets were the most frequent. In 1992, Mary Kay DeGeneva, a family studies scholar, surveyed retired people and found that among the domains of friends, family, work, education, religion, leisure, and health, the most common regret was education. On it went. At Cornell University, Victoria Medvec and Thomas Gilovich, who conducted the famous Olympic medal study I described in Chapter 3, in 1994 asked an assortment of people about their regrets. Education, both missed educational opportunities and bad educational choice, came out on top. Personal relationships, missed romantic opportunity, and unwise romantic adventure finished next. The following year, Medvec and Gilovich studied the regrets of 70-somethings who as children had been identified as high IQ prodigies. Once again, education topped their list, including regrets about wasting time in college, choosing the wrong field of study, and not completing enough schooling. In 2005, Neil Rose and Amy Somerville decided to round up the existing research to determine with greater certainty which domains in life produce the greatest potential for regret. Their meta-analytic summary examined 9 previous studies, including the ones I just mentioned, and established 12 categories of regret. For example, career: if only I were a dentist. Romance: I wish I'd married Jake instead of Edward. And parenting: if only I'd spent more time with my kids. Education again came out on top. 32% of the 3,041 participants in the studies they analyzed selected it as their prime regret. Education is the number one regret, at least in part because in contemporary society, new and further education of one sort or another is available to nearly all individuals, they concluded. If you didn't finish college, you might be able to return. If you needed additional training or skills, the right courses might be available. If you didn't earn an undergraduate degree in your 20s, maybe you can pursue one in your 40s or 50s. Opportunity breeds regret, they wrote, and education is open to continual modification throughout life. Rose and Somerville titled their paper, What We Regret Most and Why, and its conclusion seems straightforward. But this analysis didn't settle the issue. They and other researchers soon discovered that their answer to the what was faulty, and that their answer to the why revealed something deeper than they realized. What do people really regret? The studies that concluded that education was our greatest regret, despite passing peer review, were pocked with flaws. For instance, most of them took place on college campuses, where concerns about degrees, majors, and curriculum pervade conversation. If the surveys had been conducted in, say, hospitals, pharmacies, or doctor's offices, perhaps health regrets would have dominated. More important, as Rose and Somerville note, the previous research relied on samples of convenience rather than representative slices of the total population. In one study, researchers asked graduate students to hand out questionnaires to people they knew. Not exactly the gold standard for random sampling. The study of retired people surveyed 122 older adults living near Purdue University. Even though it's unlikely that as Western Indiana goes, so goes the rest of the world. In another study, the interviews were a bricolage of 10 emeritus professors, 11 nursing home residents, 40 undergraduate students, and 16 clerical and custodial staff. Rose and Somerville noted that 73% of the total sample in their meta-analysis were women, hardly the gender ratio that statistics best practices demand. An overwhelming number of the people surveyed were white. Even the Gallup polls, which were more representative of the U.S. population, often produced less than definitive results. In the 1953 poll, 15% of people chose education as their single biggest regret. But an even larger portion, about 40%, gave more than one answer to the question. What was needed, Rose and Somerville concluded toward the end of their paper, was a survey that represented the diversity and complexity of the entire country. And in 2011, Rose and his colleague Mike Morrison took up the challenge. They reached beyond the college campus with a telephone poll of 370 people from across America. Random digit dialing ensured the sample didn't skew toward any single region or demographic group. They asked their participants to report one significant regret in detail, which a team of independent raters then assigned to one of 12 life domains. It was the first truly representative portrait of where in life the typical American has their biggest regrets, Rose and Morrison wrote. The portrait they offered, titled Regrets of the Typical American, Findings from a Nationally Representative Sample, looked quite different from what had come before. The regrets were widely distributed across several areas of life, with no single category capturing more than 20% of the public mind. Regrets involving romance, lost loves, and unfulfilling relationships were the most common, comprising about 19% of the total regrets. Family finished next with 17%. Education and career each garnered 14%. This more diverse sample also allowed researchers to derive other insights. For example, women were more likely than men to have romance and family regrets. People with the least formal education were more likely to have education regrets, while single, unattached people harbored more romance regrets. The reasons also veered from previous findings. Once again, the researchers concluded that regret hinged on opportunity. However, while the earlier study suggested that regret lurked in realms where people perceived lots of opportunities, this study found the opposite. Areas where the opportunity had vanished, for instance, considering oneself too old for additional education, produced the most regrets. Such low-opportunity regrets, in which the problem could not be fixed, outnumbered high-opportunity regrets, in which the problem could be fixed, by a solid margin. So, more than a half century after scholars and surveyors began probing individuals about their regrets, they had some answers to their two core questions. What do people regret? Lots of stuff. Why do they have those regrets? Something about opportunity. The outcome remained intriguing, but unsatisfying. Okay, one more time. The world of survey research has changed considerably since 1953. For that very first regret poll, Gallup and his team interviewed about 1,500 people, often in person, and tabulated the responses without the assistance of even a mainframe computer. Today, My 3-year-old smartphone packs more power than the computing might of all the world's universities in the 1950s. And the laptop on which I wrote this sentence connects me to billions of people across the globe and houses on its hard drive free open source software that can analyze massive amounts of data with such speed and ease it would astonish mid-20th century statisticians. I'm no George Gallup, but today's tools are so powerful and the costs are dropping so quickly that even an amateur like me can follow his lead. So, nagged by the sense that we still didn't truly understand what people regret, I tried to find out myself. Working with a large software and data analytics company, which itself contracted with firms that assemble panels of participants, we created the largest and most representative American survey on regret ever attempted. The American Regret Project. We polled 4,489 adults whose gender, age, race, marital status, geography, income, and education level reflected the composition of the entire U.S. population. The survey, a full version of which you can find online at www.danpink.com/survey-results, asked participants 7 demographic questions and 18 research questions, including the big one. Regrets are part of life. We all have something we wish we had done differently, or some action we wish we had taken or not taken. Please look back on your life for a moment, then describe in 2 or 3 sentences one significant regret you have. Thousands upon thousands of regrets came spilling into our database. We asked people to place their regret into 1 of 8 categories: career, family, meaning parents, children, and grandchildren, partners, meaning spouses and significant others, education, health, finances, friends, something else. And we posed several other questions, many of which you'll hear about later in the book. In our survey, family took the top spot. Nearly 22% of respondents voiced a regret in this category, followed closely by the 19% whose regret involved partners. Running just behind and bunched together tightly were education, career, and finance regrets. Health and friends regrets rounded out the list. In other words, the largest and most representative survey of regret ever conducted reached a clear conclusion. American regrets span a wide range of domains rather than cluster into any single category. People do indeed regret a lot of stuff: family relationships, romantic choices, career moves, educational paths, and more. Maybe that shouldn't surprise us. After all, regret is universal. It's a fundamental part of being human. Human life spreads across multiple domains. We're parents, sons, daughters, spouses, partners, employees, bosses, students, spenders, investors, citizens, friends, and more. Why wouldn't regret straddle domains too? What's more, regret makes us better. It sharpens decisions, boosts performance, and deepens meaning. Why would its benefits not reach across life domains? Yet even this outcome remains unsatisfying. It offered a glimmer of understanding, but not nearly the illumination I was seeking. And as I returned to the data and collected thousands more entries worldwide in the World Regret Survey, I discovered the reason. The question was sound. I was just looking for the answer in the wrong place.
I didn't practice or give it my all while playing high school basketball. I think it's because I was afraid of being compared and then being worse than my brother, which ultimately happened because of my lack of effort. Male, 24, Utah.
Pretending to be less smart and inventive than I actually am, simply to please or not upset others. This also includes business meetings with clients and then later hearing she's useless in client meetings. Female, 39, Saudi Arabia.
I regret not learning more, sooner, about racism. Female, 78, Pennsylvania.
6. The 4 Core Regrets. Kevin Wang has an education regret. In 2013, when he was a senior biology major at Johns Hopkins University, he planned to become a doctor, just like all 4 of his grandparents. His grades were strong. The only step that remained was the medical college admission test, the MCAT. But as Kevin explained almost a decade later, he procrastinated so badly on studying for my MCAT that I bombed the test and ended up not getting into medical school. Today he works in a New York City hospital, but as an administrator who monitors costs rather than a physician who sees patients. On the other side of the United States, in Southern California, John Welches also has an education regret.
As I neared the end of completing my BA in creative writing, my professors urged me to apply for an MFA. They said my writing was strong and would benefit from that level of focus. I'd even won the 2 fiction awards put out by the program. The problem: I was getting married a month before graduation. What does a newlywed do after graduating college? Gets a job.
So instead of heeding his genuine interest and his mentor's counsel, he skipped the master's program, slunk my way into bank work, and landed in a soul-sucking job as a copywriter. 2 American men harboring the same regret: a graduate education they didn't pursue for a career they don't have. But how similar really are they? Kevin regrets not taking his future seriously. John regrets not taking a risk. Kevin regrets not meeting other people's expectations. John regrets not setting the right expectations for himself. Kevin regrets a failure to be conscientious. John regrets a failure to be bold. On the surface, their regrets occupy similar terrain. Below the surface, the roots diverge. Sometimes when I was analyzing entries in the World Regret Survey, I felt less like I was studying our most misunderstood emotion and more like I was operating a gigantic online confessional. For instance, hundreds of people offered a partner regret, like the one that came from a 61-year-old man in Australia.
Being unfaithful to my wife and justifying it selfishly by convincing myself she was the problem is my biggest regret.
A few weeks after that submission arrived, a 37-year-old Canadian man described a regret about how he once treated his peers.
I regret bullying a few different kids in my grade growing up. When I think back on it, I cringe and I can't help but wish for a chance to go back and change it.
A short time after that, another 37-year-old man, this one from California, revealed,
I cheated in a student election by tossing out a vote for my opponent's friend, who I knew had only come to the meeting to vote for his buddy. I don't think I even needed to do that in order to win, which made compromising my integrity that much sadder.
3 men with regrets that span a wide swath of territory: an Australian marriage, a Canadian childhood, a California election. But how different, really, are they? All involve a moral breach. At a moment in their lives now stamped in memory, all 3 faced a choice: honor their principles or betray them. And at that moment, all 3 chose wrongly. On the surface, their regrets poke through different patches of life's landscape. Below the surface, they grow from common roots. Similarity and difference. If you've ever traveled to a place where people speak a language different from your own, you might have felt a twinge of envy when you encountered a 4-year-old. I know that's happened to me. I began trying to learn Spanish as an adult. It was not bonita. I mangled irregular verbs. I mixed up genders and misplaced adjectives. And the subjunctive? Dios mío! Yet whenever I saw preschoolers in a Spanish-speaking community in the United States or abroad, their speech appeared effortless. The work of Noam Chomsky helped me understand why. Until the late 1950s, most scientists believed that children were linguistic blank slates who learned language mostly by repeating adults. When children's mimicry was accurate, they'd be praised. When it was off, they'd be corrected. And over time, this process would etch onto their little brains the circuitry of whatever language their parents spoke. The wide variety of tongues spoken around the world testify to this truth. Yes, some languages, Danish and German, for example, shared a history, but language itself lacked a single common foundation. Beginning with a 1957 book called Syntactic Structures, Chomsky capsized these beliefs. He argued that every language was built atop a deep structure, a universal framework of rules lodged in the human brain. When children learn to speak, they're not simply parroting sounds, they're activating grammatical wiring that already exists. Language wasn't an acquired skill, Chomsky said. It was an innate capacity. A child learning to speak Vietnamese or learning to speak Croatian is not much different from a child learning to walk in Hanoi or learning to walk in Zagreb. They're just doing what humans do. Yes, individual languages differ, but only in their surface structures. Hindi, Polish, and Swahili are individual variants on a single template. Underpinning them all is the same deep structure. Chomsky's idea revolutionized the study of linguistics and expanded our understanding of the brain and mind. He acquired a few detractors over his career, including some who rejected his left-wing politics, but his contribution to science is as undeniable as it is enduring. And one consequence of his work was the realization that among the languages of the world, similarity often conceals difference, and difference often conceals similarity. To cite one of Chomsky's most famous examples, these two English sentences seem nearly identical. John is eager to please. John is easy to please. They both contain five words, a noun, followed by a verb, followed by an adjective, followed by an infinitive. Four of the words are the same. The other varies by only a few letters. But one layer down, the sentences are quite different. In the first, John is the subject. In the second, John is the object. If we restate the second sentence as, "It is easy to please John," the meaning holds. If we restate the first sentence as, "It is eager to please John," the meaning crumbles. Their surface structures are the same, but that doesn't tell us much because their deep structures diverge. Meanwhile, these two sentences seem different.
Hyun went to the store. 하윤이는 그 가게에 갔다. 하윤, 하윤이는 went, 갔다, to the store, 그 가게.
But one layer down, they're identical. A noun phrase, 하윤, a verb phrase, went, and a prepositional phrase, to the store. Their surface structures differ, but their deep structures are the same. Chomsky demonstrated that what appeared complicated and disorderly wasn't the full story. Beneath the Tower of Babel cacophony ran a common human melody. It took me a while to figure out, but I've discovered that regret, too, has both a surface structure and a deep structure. What's visible and easy to describe, the realms of life such as family, education, and work, is far less significant than a hidden architecture of human motivation and aspiration that lies beneath it. The deep structure of regret. Reading and rereading thousands of regrets is daunting, categorizing and recategorizing them even more so. But as I plowed back through the entries, I began identifying certain words and phrases that kept appearing with no noticeable correlation to the respondent's age, location, gender, or the topic that person was describing. Diligent, more stable, bad habits, take a chance, assert myself, explore, wrong, not right, knew I shouldn't, missed, more time, love. Words and phrases like these offer clues to the deep structure. And as they piled up, like thousands of dots of colors in a pointillist painting, they began to take shape. The shapes span the lives of all of us and infiltrate every aspect of how we think, feel, and live. They divide into four categories of human regret. Foundation regrets. The first deep structure category cuts across nearly all the surface categories. Many of our education, finance, and health regrets are actually different outward expressions of the same core regret, our failure to be responsible, conscientious, or prudent. Our lives require some basic level of stability. Without a measure of physical well-being and material security, other goals become difficult to imagine and even harder to pursue. Yet sometimes our individual choices undermine this long-term need. We shirk in school and leave before we should. We overspend and undersave. We adopt unhealthy habits. When such decisions eventually cause the platform of our lives to wobble and our futures not to live up to our hopes, regret follows. Boldness regrets. A stable platform for our lives is necessary, but not sufficient. One of the most robust findings in the academic research and my own is that over time, we are much more likely to regret the chances we didn't take than the chances we did. Again, the surface domain, whether the risk involved our education, our work, or our love lives, doesn't matter much. What haunts us is the inaction itself. Foregone opportunities to leave our hometown, or launch a business, or chase a true love, or see the world, all linger in the same way. Moral regrets. Most of us want to be good people, yet we often face choices that tempt us to take the low road. When we travel that path, we don't always feel bad immediately. Rationalization is such a powerful mental weapon, it should require a background check. But over time, these morally dubious decisions can gnaw at us. And once again, the realm in which they occur, deceiving a spouse, cheating on a test, swindling a business partner, is less significant than the act itself. When we behave poorly or compromise our belief in our own goodness, regret can build and then persist. Connection regrets. Our actions give our lives direction, but other people give those lives purpose. A massive number of human regrets stem from our failure to recognize and honor this principle. Fractured or unrealized relationships with spouses, partners, parents, children, siblings, friends, classmates, and colleagues constitute the largest deep structure category of regret. Connection regrets arise anytime we neglect the people who help establish our own sense of wholeness. When those relationships fray or disappear or never develop, we feel an abiding loss. The next four chapters will explore each of these deep structure regrets. You'll hear people around the world describing foundation, boldness, moral, and connection regrets. But as the chorus of voices builds, if you listen carefully, you'll also hear something else, the vivid harmony of what we need to lead a fulfilling life.
I regret not standing up to the men who raped me. Now that I am stronger both mentally and physically, I will never let a man hurt me like that again. Female, 19, Texas.
In 1964, I was invited to join Mississippi Freedom Summer by a college classmate. I took a job with my father's boss in Oklahoma City instead. Male, 76, California.
Following a career path for money instead of for my passion or work I would actually enjoy. My mother convinced me I would starve to death if I pursued a career in art. So now I am stuck behind a desk, tangled in management red tape, and the life is draining out of me. Female, 45, Minnesota.
7. Foundation regrets. A few days after he graduated from high school in 1996, Jason Drent landed a full-time job as a sales associate at Best Buy, the large electronics retailer. Jason's work ethic was ferocious, and his industriousness soon paid off. He quickly became the youngest sales manager in Best Buy history. A few years later, another retailer snatched him away, and Jason scaled the ranks of that company. District manager, regional manager. Before long, he was earning a six-figure salary and shouldering executive responsibility. He began a series of career-enhancing moves from Ohio to Illinois to Massachusetts to Michigan to Tennessee. Today, at age 43, he heads employee relations at the corporate headquarters of a large apparel chain. By all appearances, Jason Drent is a success story. A young man who endured a difficult childhood, including a stint at a group home, but whose brains, ambition, and grit fueled his ascent in corporate America. But his story, which he told in the World Regret Survey, comes with an important footnote.
I regret not saving money diligently ever since I started working. It's nearly crushing every day to think about how hard I've worked for the last 25 years or so, but financially, I have nothing to show for it.
Jason has a sterling resume, but barely a dime in the bank, a positive record of achievement, but a negative net worth. From his first paycheck at Best Buy, he vowed to himself, "I'm going to buy whatever I want as soon as I can." He wasn't especially extravagant. It was a lot of nonsensical day-to-day stuff, he told me. Decent car, some clothing, the big man on campus pride, as he described it, of always picking up the tab at restaurant dinners with friends. It felt good. But the small daily choices that once beguiled him now haunt him. "It's kind of sad looking back," he told me. "I should have more resources at this point." For a guy whom antiquity scholars say might never have existed, Aesop has enjoyed a pretty good run as an author. The fables that bear his name, but are likely the product of many creators over many years, date to 5 centuries before the Common Era. They've been bestsellers for more than 2,000 years, fixtures of bookstore children's sections and bedtime story sessions. They remain popular even in the age of podcasts and streaming services because who among us does not enjoy hearing life lessons delivered by talking animals? Among the best known of Aesop's fables is The Ant and the Grasshopper. The story is deceptively simple. During a long summer, the grasshopper lolls about, plays the fiddle, and tries to entice its friend the ant to join in dancing and other insect debauchery. The ant declines. It chooses instead the more arduous task of lugging corn and grain into storage. When winter arrives, the grasshopper realizes its error. It clutches its fiddle for warmth, but soon dies of hunger. The ant and its family, meanwhile, eat well and happily from the store of food that this more forward-thinking creature has collected during the summer. During one of my conversations with Jason, I told him he reminded me of the grasshopper. He shook his head ruefully. "I never took steps to prepare," he said. During the summer of his life, there were a lot of cavalier moments where I enjoyed saying, "So what?" and just rolling through it. But in the end, he said, it was 25 years of fiddling. The first of the 4 categories in the deep structure of regret are what I call foundation regrets. Foundation regrets arise from our failures of foresight and conscientiousness. Like all deep structure regrets, they start with a choice. At some early moment, we face a series of decisions. One set represents the path of the ant. These choices require short-term sacrifice, but in the service of a long-term payoff. The other choices represent the path of the grasshopper. This route demands little exertion or assiduousness in the short run, but risks exacting a cost in the long run. At that juncture, we choose the path of the grasshopper. We spend too much and save too little. We drink and carouse at the expense of exercising regularly and eating right. We apply minimal and grudging effort in school, at home, or on the job. The full ramifications of these incremental choices don't materialize immediately, but over time, they slowly accrue. Soon, the full consequences become too towering to deny, and eventually, too massive to repair. Foundation regrets sound like this: "If only I'd done the work." The lure and the logic. Foundation regrets begin with an irresistible lure and end with an inexorable logic. Take this Canadian woman who hails from Alberta, but whose regret comes straight out of Aesop.
I regret not looking after my health through the years. I did lots to hurt my health and not much to help it. Also, I did not save for retirement, and now I'm 62, unhealthy, and broke.
We typically read The Ant and the Grasshopper as a morality tale, but it's also a story about cognition. By partying all summer instead of gathering food for the winter, the grasshopper succumbed to what economists call temporal discounting. He overvalued the now and undervalued, that is, discounted, the later. When this bias grips our thinking, we often make regrettable decisions. The grasshopper prized fiddling in the moment more than eating in the future. The Alberta woman valued gratification in youth more than health and satisfaction in maturity. Jason Drent says his early paychecks made him feel so invincible that they blinded his view into the distance. In both the American Regret Project and the World Regret Survey, respondents described their experience of temporal discounting with